So welcome everybody to the second episode of the DQMH podcast. Our special guest today is Fabiola Della Cueva. Welcome, Fabiola.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for inviting me.
Why don't we start with where did the idea for DQMH come from?
So the architecture itself was something that I started using when I worked with Justin Gorse for a project for JKI. So I was doing contracting work for JKI, and Justin and I were working on a project, and that was using events. And that's what he presented in 2011 for the CLA Summit, and it was called Public and Private Events. And he used the JKI state machine as the core. I had already been using events before that, but that was the first time that it was formalized in an architecture. And internal to Delacore, I was already looking for what would be the template that I would start from every time. And I dabbled a little bit into queues as the transfer mechanism. I even started with one where we were doing classes. It was going more towards like what Actor Framework was doing. And if you think about it, this is the time when Actor Framework was brewing up, and we started discussing DQMH. One of the things, I guess the triggers is, I started testing with different customers, different architectures, depending on what they were doing. And the one that I saw that kept working better was using the user events. And the reason that worked better is because we could do a lot of testing and separate the modules and isolate them from the rest. However, I started seeing that the customers would call us just to create an event, because there's so many steps to create an event, right? So they understood how it worked, and they could do all the maintenance within their modules themselves. But creating an event was something that would stress them out. So they would call me just to create, or any of the members in our team, they would call us just to create an event. So that's kind of like where it started. Then finally, we had a customer that said that after years of working with them, it was the VI, or it was really two VIs. And he finally, after telling him that we needed to modularize that application, they started hiring Navi developers, and we had a new hurdle, which was different levels of proficiency working together and different levels of IP access. Right. They customer wanted to make sure that not a single developer had access to the entire application. So that like screams modules, right? We need to modularize.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, it's a long story, and I'm already kind of getting into the creation, but that's where it started. It was a need for an architecture that could be maintained by different levels of proficiency, that could be isolated, and it could be tested.
So this is what, circa 2011, 2012, when these ideas were starting to come into fruition?
Yes.
I think one of the powerful things about DQMH is obviously there's a lot of scripting under the hood. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So the like I said, the one of the struggles was, how can we make the events easier to create? And the only answer really was scripting. So that was, and there's a graph, and maybe, you later can edit adding it. There's a graph that we showed early on our presentations that showed the public and private events, the queue message handler, and the queue message handler by NI, the NI queue message handler, and then the QMH. And what we were trying to do was to make the private and public events easier to understand, easier to teach, and then lower the barrier of entry of what level of developer you needed to be. So the way we reduce the complexity, or the making it easier to understand, was to change the vocabulary. So private and public events was super confusing, because the public events were wrapped by private VIs in the library, and the private events were wrapped by public VIs in the library.
Okay.
And the cross between private and public, and it is a leaky abstraction, right? It's telling me too much about how it is implemented. When really what I want to understand is the direction of communication. So that came about in 2014 that we said, okay, we're going to call them requests and we're going to call them broadcasts. So instead of private and public, we're going to just that change in nomenclature we did. And then to make it more accessible and lower the barrier of entry, we're going to add scripting. And the whole idea was encouraging the developer to do not the right thing, as there's only a single right thing, but to do the best thing that we think. And if you have been using DKMH, you will see that anytime you create an event, the first thing that pops into your face is the API tester. That's our way of encouraging you to do the right thing, which is how am I going to test this before you actually implement it? So those were the two main things to make it more accessible is in the scripting tools and the nomenclature change.
I agree with you on that one. As a user of DQMH, it's like having a little Fabiola on my shoulder all the time, just gently suggesting, now what you want to do now is update your API tester, or it's probably a good time to run that validation tool. And I think that's really good. It's not forcing you to do it. It's not trying to get in your way and say, do it this way. It's just reminding you of good programming practice. And I think that idea has only come to me recently about DQMH, that that's there in the background, or not in the background, just subtly in the foreground, helping the developer, helping you make good habits in your programming.
So one of the things, I mean, and by the way, you're not the first one to say that. I have another customer that says it's like having Fabiola package into the code. They also say it's a way where they don't need to hire an architect because the architecture is pretty much set. They still need to do work on their design and do a lot of thinking about how the modules, but they don't have to be having someone working on the framework. They just know that that works.
Yes.
And that has worked really great. But yeah, the whole idea is, I realize this is another thing, and this also we do with VI Analyzer tests. Anytime we finish a project, we do a retrospect of the project. Like we do retrospects in between the sprints, but always at the very end, we're like, okay, what were the biggest headaches, and how could we have prevented them? And the having a tester since the beginning, that was the one thing that I learned early on in my career as a consultant, that when bugs come about, you want to be able to isolate the piece of code you're working in. You don't want to have, I say this all the time, you don't want to have to run the entire program in order to test the printer, which I have a customer where we always have to do this. Of course, this is code that I do, right? Right? So what are the things, and based on that is like, okay, now, what are the things that I can enforce by training someone or with code reviews? And I realized, I mean, I can be very tough and be harsh, right? Wouldn't it be better if the computer would just be like, hey, you may want to do this before you go show it to Fab? So that's what we did with the BI Analyzer test and with the scripting tools and with having a similar way of everyone in the team program. That's more about how DKMH came about and why we went with scripting.
So I'm just going to jump into a little tangent here then. Tell us about those VI Analyzer tests. Are they something that is that another product of Delacore's, or how does that work?
We have a product that is called the Software Engineering Tools, or Software Engineering Tools by Delacore. And then we name that toolkit to each of our customers. And it's really a springboard. It's not meant to be just used out of the box and have all the answers, but it comes with example style guidelines. It comes with code review processes, with some ideas on which source code control workflows you can use. And then it comes with a set of VI Analyzer tests. And like one of them, and I have it on the video too, we can put on the links to the podcast. I have a video about it. My favorite one is I kept having issues where we would hire new Lavi developers and they would forget about handling the error on the file prompt. So the end user would be the one that would get the operation canceled by user. And I'm like, okay, there should be a better way than me yelling, why did you do it again, right?
Yes.
And we created a custom VN analyzer test that checks for that. That product is not on the LiveTools network. It's more something that we sell directly to our customers, just because once you get it, you really get access to the entire IP. And the value really is on the customization. Once we give the springboard to our customers, then we work with them to figure out what are the other pet peeves they have, how to modify the style guideline to fit their needs, and then which of the review processes and the workflows we have will work better for them. So that's where we adjust it. But instead of, like, you can tell already, I don't like to start with blank pages. Right. I like to start with something that's already done. So I feel like it's a lot easier to create your own architecture on top of VQMH because it's already there. It's a lot easier to create your own style guidelines if you already have a template. And the same thing that I always say is, like, I do a lot. The faster we show the customer what they don't want, the faster we figure out what they need. It's a lot easier for them to say, I don't like this, or this will work better, or I really need this, once they start interacting with the software, than sitting down with them and trying to write a bunch of requirements. So that applies. The whole idea of not starting with a blank page applies to the software engineering tools by Delacore and the VA analyzer test and all of that. It's like small iterations to make it better.
Yeah, it sounds like a good suite of materials to get started with. So moving along the DQMH journey, when was the first release of DQMH?
2015, because it came out with 2014. We started using it in 2014, like 4 months. Like, again, different flavors of DQMH had been in use with different customers. But the first package that had a scripting tools that was called the Delacore Queue Message Handler, that was packaged, that had the palettes, like all that stuff, that will be in 2014. And it was released to the public in 2015. We were going through the validation test the other day, and we always test validating since the earliest versions. And then we were like, wait a second, 1.0 never made it to the public, right? Like we released with 2.0. So we should probably stop testing with that because that was more like a prototype. And then when we have to decide, if we find out on the validation, for those people that don't know, is tools that ship with the DQMH that either help you figure out if your code still up to DQMH standards. The validation tools allows us to, anytime we add a new version, we add validation tools and fixing tools that allow you to script any changes or improvements that we've done in the new versions. So we were finding out that we had problems with upgrading from DQMH 1.0 all the way to 5. And we were like, okay, should we really be doing that and adding that extra work? Or should we just say, if you have a really old version of DQMH, you probably, because you still have access to the previous versions through the LiveTools network. So you probably should go version by version and do the validation and then fixing them instead of trying to go on one sweep. But yeah, it was 2014 was the first one. Then we released in 2015. And then in 2016 is when we won Labby Product of the Year for the Labby Tools Network.
That would have been an exciting time.
Yeah, that was really cool. Yeah. And unfortunately, you can only win in 1 year. So
yeah. Otherwise, it'd be the fourth time in a row coming up, wouldn't it? So we started using it at Wired In Software not long after that, sort of late 2016. We were in the market for finding a framework, and we looked at Actor Framework as well as DQMH. But my team of Labvy developers at the time, they didn't have any object-oriented experience, and we just thought, let's give this DQMH thing a go, and haven't looked back since. So it's, you know, it's working well, and it continues to be improved, which is, you know, the reason we have stuck with it. You know, it's not a dormant product.
Which, you know, This is kind of important to bring it up, because there was one time in the forum somebody said, but they continue to do releases, so it's not stable. And I was like, wait a second, LabVIEW releases every year, right? It is on the contrary, it should be a good feature for you to know that we're actively using the product and figuring out ways to improve it. And now that we have the DQMH Trusted Advisors, is like, you guys get priority. So we do a release with all the things that need to be fixed or the new features, and then we do a release with the features that you guys choose, right? So that also has helped us, because we know that we have a group of people that are extensively using DQMH and that we trust your advice. That's why you're trusted advisors, to even make it better. And it has been great. Like, York was so excited that we added the scripting tool that adds the little icon to the broadcast.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's something that it would have never crossed my mind, but it does make code a lot easier to read. And then there was yours, was the making the timeout for a request and wait for reply, return an error, which is like, why didn't we do it since the beginning? And then we started going back and we actually found out discussions, by the way, I don't know if I shared this with you, but the reason we didn't do it is because we were basing off how the wait for notification works. But that's how a primitive works, not a function. So really, as a developer, I would expect to get an error if it timed out. So,
but it's in there now, and it works really well. And you can decide there and then whether, you know, the error just comes out, which is really handy. So just getting back to the scripting. So obviously, it's a critical element of the tool. I think when I was talking to you about this once, you were saying that it was intended as a marketing device.
Yeah. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so this is the discussions on why did we make the DQMH public, right? Because it was intended to be something that we were using. We were using it with some customers. We were not using it with all the customers. We still had some of all the other architectures that I was talking about. With different customers. So the customer that needed it the most, we started talking to them and we're like, you know what? We have this issue. Every time we meet a new customer, they want to see our code. And because of NDA, we cannot really show them the code. So we don't really have a way to showcase how good we are. The other thing is, at that point, we were starting to do more scripting tools for different customers, and we were doing the analyzer tests and everything, and we thought that's something we enjoy, so we wanted to do more of that. And how do you advertise scripting for people that don't know what scripting does? And we had already started developing some of these scripting tools for this customer, for the entry-level developers, and we had already agreed that anything that was development for their project, they paid for. Anything that was a scripting, we paid for, so we could keep it as our IP.
Right.
All right. And we're like, well, this is what we want to show. We want to show that we can take somebody else's architecture and then automate it and make it accessible for every member of the team. So we talked to the customer, and actually, he was the one that said, why don't you just make it public? Why didn't you just put it out? And then we had to have a whole discussion about, do we sell it or do we just put it out? And we're like, okay, what is it that we want to get with this? And at the time, what we wanted was marketing. What we wanted was a way to show people, look, when we say that we can automate your framework, is take, for example, the NIQMH. We took the NIQMH, we added user events, we added a scripting, and now we have these architecture that is very similar to that, but it comes with all these automation tools. So the idea was, let me showcase how we can do automation tools. It also was a way of saying, we got a certified product from NI, and if you want to see our code, go see that. Like, I cannot show you customer code, but I can show you that. So that was the idea. It was going to be a marketing tool. What ended up happening is, when we showed it, when we visit customers or had a meeting with customer and we would show it, they would be like, forget about my architecture. let's just use yours. Like, it's already working. What are you talking about, right? Why would you want to create a scripting tools for my architecture where you already have figured out how to start multiple modules? The testers, that's one of the things that a lot of people, especially the ones that have had long hours debugging, appreciate. So it started becoming more like that, like people actually deciding to use it. So yeah, so sorry to say that we didn't really get any scripting work from putting the QMH out there, besides what we already had with the BI analyzer test.
Yes.
And yeah, I had never imagined that this would happen, like this many people would use it. The year I met you at NI Week, it was 2017, right? Is that when you went to NI Week?
Yes. Yes.
And people like would stop me on the hallways and just say, "Hey, Fabiola, we use your architecture. Hey, Fabiola, thank you for the videos." Hey, like, I just couldn't believe it because I mean, you had me out there, and I think it was because we won the Labby Product of the Year. That's how you found out about it. Yes. There's other people got that email and they were like, "Oh, let's go check this out."
Yeah.
But I had no idea of how many people were using it.
Yes, I remember stopping you in the hallway at just before the opening address of the Alliance Day and saying, "Oh, we use DQMH," and you wanted to corner me and say, "I need to know what you think of it." You wanted to like book a meeting with me so you could get some feedback, because you hadn't really had much feedback at that point or something.
Yeah.
So that ended up being quite a fun exercise when I took you through the project, we'd used it and you got to see how we'd applied it, and that was
a funny anecdote about that was Kim was saying, we were going through the whole thing and he's like, "Yeah, everything is great and the videos are awesome, but that lady that does the videos, she goes really fast." And I'm laughing because I'm like, "I'm that lady." I didn't think he had realized he had put two and two together. That was the same one. And then he looked at me and he started changing all colors and he's like, "Oh, you did the video." But you can
see that.
Kim is one of the converted, don't you worry. So you just raised a couple of things I want to touch on. First of all, you're talking about the IP. I'm just curious because, I seem to enter into all sorts of IP agreements all the time, but I don't do much about it. Did you formally write down what your IP was and what their IP was going to be?
Yep. Yes. This is one of the reasons why I use BI Package Manager. When I work with customers, they know that anything that is ours, and we agree this is in the beginning and it's in our contract when we start working with them, anything that we provide that is packaged via BI Package Manager will have a license agreement in it and will be our IP. And so it was pretty evident for them, right? They had to install it on their machine and they had to click I accept. So they knew that the template for a DQMH, all the menus, they were already on their Delacore. So all of that was our IP. Doing it
That's a good way of separating it, isn't it? Just whatever's in VI Package Manager, that's not mine, that's theirs. Yeah.
Yeah. And then for any drivers, we may still do them on BIPM, but then we put the customer as the author. And then, it's like it's something they can see. When they install it, they get the license agreement, and then it would say, "This code is property of whatever customer," right? So that has always made it a lot easier. It's also easier for when we come into a customer, we would say, "Okay, as a line item on the invoice, these are the packages that you're paying for." Sometimes you get customers, I say like, "No, but I don't want to pay for that." I'm like, "Okay, let me show you the amount of hours that as a company Delacore has invested on creating that package. I'm more than happy to create it from scratch for you, but then you pay time and materials for that." Right.
Right.
And most of the time when they see that, it's like, okay, we'll pay for that line item.
Yeah.
Of course, now the image is not something that we can charge. But again, it was like it's a springboard. We know the other advantage of having the image on the tools network is when we wanted to go to certain customers that would be like, we want to own it all. Like, we want to have it all, because if you get run over by a bus, which I don't understand why people always say that. Why don't they say, when you win the lottery and you move to an island and I cannot reach you anymore? No, they have to come with the run over by a bus. But anyway, how are we going to deal with this, right? So to me, saying, look, it's on the LaviTools network. It has already been reviewed by NI. By the way, all the code that you generate with our tools, it's completely open, not password protected, it's yours. Like, it's on your machine. That makes it more confident for some people. Like, okay, we're not depending on you. We can just download it from there. And even if the Delacore site goes away, the FTP site from NI is still there, so I can get it from there. And now we have the DQMH Trusted Advisor. So the same thing is like, you don't rely only on us. There's all these other companies that can help you out with DQMH. Right. So, but yeah.
Yeah, that's right. It's bigger. It's bigger than Delacore now, isn't it? It's and that's good. That's a good thing for you, for when you do win that lottery. So the other thing I wanted to quickly ask about too is whether you monetize it.
Sorry, I need to start buying tickets. I don't buy tickets, so winning the lottery. Anyway, yeah.
I always said that I'd probably do better just trying to be a professional poker player than trying to win the lottery. But anyway, so monetizing your product on the NI Tools network, you know, did you spend long thinking about whether to make it free or not?
Yes. The biggest fear we had was, what is going to be the support, the technical support volume for this thing? Like, we had no idea. I mean, one of the reasons why I was so surprised in 2017 when you approached me was we didn't have calls. We didn't have emails asking for support. I mean, later on, like on the same NI week, there was a guy that stopped me on the street and he's like, "Hey, Fabiola, are you the lady from the videos?" And I'm like, "Which videos? Like, let's make sure we're talking about videos." I'm like, "Oh, you use it? Yes." And I'm like, "How come you never asked for, you know, support calls on the forums, and you've never reached out to us?" And they're like, "No, you're kidding. You have everything on the documentation. Your videos have everything we need." And they were working with a consultant, and the consultant answered any questions they had. I talked to another person, and they were like, "Yeah, we called AEs, and they looked at our code, and they said, 'Hey, your code is very clean.'" And they were like, "Yeah, better be." So they were getting answers and support from other places other than us. But when we started, we didn't know that that was going to be the case. We figure out the minute you charge something, you are obligated to give the support, right? Mm. Like, it doesn't matter how much you charge, whether you charge $1, whether you charge $20, whether you charge $2,000. It doesn't matter. The minute somebody pays for a service, they're going to be expecting the support. Where if it's a free product, and you've seen me saying this at the forums all the time, right? If you're not happy, we will happily return your money. We will give you your money back. That helped a little bit with the pressure on not having to answer the questions right away. If it takes me 2 or 3 days, it's like, okay, it's a free product. You know, I'll get to it. Where if you have a service license agreement with a customer because they bought the product, now you have the thing where you have to answer within 24 hours or within 48 yeah. hours. So the main reason for not charging for it was that. It was we didn't know how much extra work it was going to be to support it. And then the other thing too was, you know, nobody's going to use it if we charge. And then when everybody started using it, you asked me, "Why don't you charge for it?" And like, if I was charging, you would be asking me, "Why did I charge for it?" Right. It's like, it was, we really didn't know which way.
So I think, like, as well, if you stack it up against other things, you know, I mean, using DQMH is an alternative to using Active Framework. And if Active Framework's free out of the box, you know, you're up against it already if you're charging for DQMH, aren't you?
Yeah.
Even though, you know, they serve different purposes, slightly different purposes, and are targeting slightly different levels of developer.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's something I've been wondering about, because I'd like to know how well people do when they put a tool onto the network and charge for it. You know, is it a viable thing?
Yeah, I think, and I think also our ecosystem is too small. We're not like Python or you know, C++, where there's tons of libraries out there. There's not that much. I mean, I'm hoping that changes and it gets better with time. But at the time was like we try to figure out how many people would have to buy it so it would pay for the work we had already invested in it. And it just didn't make sense. It didn't make sense. And we're like, okay, we'll figure it out. We have some tools that we sell that depend on DQMH. Again, we don't have them on the tools network. That's something more that we work directly with our customers, but we have a test sequencer. We have a configuration editor. We have several drivers that we have done. So there's different things that we have built on top of DQMH that we do monetize, but again, it's like to put them in the tools network. That's the other thing. When people say that putting toolkits in the tools network, like it's a big barrier to entry. It is in the sense that it has to be very polished, right? You have to have your documentation. You have to have, it has to be polished. You have to have nice palettes. You have to have examples. You cannot just say, hey, I have this reuse library and then just throw it to the Lavi Tools Network. If we wanted to charge, like the reason we charge for these products that are built on top of the DQMH is that then the example I was giving earlier, we don't have to create them from scratch. We know a lot of our customers are going to need them, and we're the ones that are developing anyway and customizing it further for them. If we were to do, for example, a configuration editor, if we were to put it in the tools network, we would have to add scripting tools that replace us doing that customization. Right? Yes. We would have to package ourselves into the tool. So you wouldn't have to learn how to use it. A very good example on a configuration editor is version management. You start with one configuration at the beginning of a project and it doesn't look anything like the configuration at the end, right? You start adding names, other stuff. And it's always because new features start evolving. We have a way on our code to keep version, to be able to do convert an older configuration to a newer configuration. And we have all the hooks. And we know we could just script that. It's just one of those things where it's like, okay, the return benefit, right? I'm going to be spending all this time for only a handful. But eventually, it's on our wish list. Eventually, we'll do it. That it would require that level of extra work to really put it on the tools network and say, okay, we're going to charge for this.
One of the questions, I think you've probably already covered this a little bit, but one of the questions I wanted to find out was, what was the original problems you were trying to solve that made you create DQMH?
It was the different levels of proficiency in the same team. It was the having the tool be the one that tells you what to do, and not having someone breathing over your shoulder, have people have more or less the same style so you can support code that somebody else created in the team. There was also that we wanted it to work with test end, so to make it be easy to call from test end. And the reason when we were debating like what is the architecture that we're going to use, right? Like I said, I had the experience with Jorg's and Justin Gore's presentation and the architecture he had that used the JKI state machine. They're like, do we use that? We were trying to figure out, like, again, and going back to the we want the marketing thing, we figure out, no, we'll take the NIQMH because that's something that a lot more people are going to be familiar with and they can just launch it from the getting started. But yeah, it was those familiar code, something that would, when the customer, your first customers call AEs for support, the AEs didn't even need to know that it was a DQMH template, right? They would just answer their questions. So,
yeah,
I think those are, I'm probably missing some, but those were the main ones.
Yeah, I think like you touched on earlier, not relying on Delacore for making small changes.
Yeah, the one thing I think that differentiates us, and I think it you agree you would do the same thing. We don't really like customers depending on us. I don't like, and I tell these all the time to customers, is like, I like the challenge of doing a new architecture or designing a new, solving a new problem. The being called to just add a new user event is like, okay, you're paying me, but really, like, you, I don't feel like you're getting the best use of my time, even if you're paying for it, right? So I don't like customers depending on us. I'd like more to teach someone how to fish and teach them how to use the tools. And hopefully the next time they call me is because they have a bigger problem to solve. And they're at that point. And that has always been more fulfilling to me than just doing the same thing over and over. That was also the fear of some of the early customers that we use early versions of DQMH before it went public, was like, but now we're going to depend on you because we're using this architecture. And that's when you learn, okay, what's the spiel, right? Well, it's all open. Right. There's no proper protection. All the BIs are copied directly on your directories. And I was like, oh, okay, then we're fine. So,
I guess it depends. So Delacour's customers are typically LabVIEW programmers as well, right?
Yeah, we do have a couple of customers that don't know even what LabVIEW is, that just come because they want to solve a problem.
Yes.
But the majority is LabVIEW, especially LabVIEW teams or Lone Wolf developers that have worked by themselves for years, and now all of a sudden they have a team and they don't know how to work with a team, or a team of LabVIEW developers that has been working with LabVIEW for years, and then their bosses start saying, like, why is it that you're not as efficient as you used to be? Why is it that you're having all these problems? And then we can come in and help them out. So, yeah, and that has been, you know, throughout the years, we have been migrating more from turnkey solution, which we still do, to more of let us teach you how to do this.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so speaking from my experience at Wired In, we're very much, I guess, on the turnkey side. So, yeah, we get all those requests to add a new event or a new feature, because probably 90% of our customers have never even touched LabVIEW, but either, you know, their existing systems were based on LabVIEW, or, you know, we're offering a service that meets their needs, and it doesn't really matter if it's LabVIEW or Python or whatever. It's just, you can help us solve our problem. Yeah.
This is another thing too, is some of our earlier customers was a lot of bring us in to get them started, and then we would just come back for architecture reviews or code reviews. So we had already the experience of doing code for someone else that would maintain it. And this is also something different from other alliance partners. I remember I have customers all over the world, and I remember one time in Boston, one of the sales people was like, "Why is that customer working with you?" I gave them a list of all the local partners, and I'm like, "Okay, which one of your local partners is willing to sit down with them, share screens, and explain their thought process as they're programming?" And then, like, not return these particular customer, they wanted to maintain their code. They wanted to learn how to maintain their code because it was code that somebody else built for them. That person left. And now they're left with this code that they don't know. And they took all the training from an AI, and they're like, but I don't know how to read this code. Right? Yeah. So that particular customer's needs was, can you train me to read this? Can you train me to maintain this? And then can you train me to improve it? And that's an example of someone that I've worked with, you know, years. And they, when they come back, it's always with more interesting and new projects for us to deal with. But that's just an example. There's others that done. And when a customer comes in, a new customer comes in, and they request a turnkey solution, I always ask, okay, for sure, we'll give you the source code, right? Are you visualizing yourself maintaining this tool, or do you want us to maintain it? Not, I mean, we're probably going to make the same decisions, but the difference is, if a customer is intending to maintain the program, I will only do that if they are part of the development team. So even if it's just weekly code reviews, but they have to be familiarized. I don't do this. Right. I worked with another Alliance partner early on, and we would do these things where we would do the entire code and then we do a training so they could maintain it. That's insane. There's like so many little decisions that are made throughout the project that if the person that's maintaining them is not aware of, they're going to make the same.
Yeah. Speaking from my own experience, we've done exactly that. And it, sort of afterwards sort of thought, oh, that kind of fell a bit flat. Like we just unloaded on them this whole project with a whole lot of design decisions that, you know, we made up on the fly, some of it. And they then have to pick it all up and try and make it work and try and edit it. So yeah, it's, it wasn't fun.
So my recommendation, if you do any of those again, is like, even if they're not going to be on the day-to-day development, do make them part of the retrospect or make it a point to do a code review like more often. So by the time they get to the final part, they already know. And that's the other thing is like the faster the customer tells me what they don't want, the faster I figure out what they need. And the way I get that is by giving them early releases. So a lot of the times, even for customers that don't know what LabVIEW is, sometimes our early releases is just a panel where you can launch all the API testers of the DQMH, right? So it's obviously something that they're not going to use at the end. And some customers get like pushback is like, oh, is this what you're giving me? I'm like, no. This is like very early release. I just want to make sure we're on the right direction. And after a while, they appreciate it. There was the example of a customer that was, robotic hands, right? Picking vials and stuff. And we gave them, and eventually everything was automated, but we gave them an early API tester where you would just tell the motor to go to certain positions. And they were so happy we did that because they figure out early on that the motor, if it went from position A to position C and a particular vial was in there, it would crash the vial. And that was something that they would have, if we operated like traditional approach, go away for 6 months and come back with the final release, they would have found out that the specs they gave us were wrong. And if you went from position A to position C, you destroy the vial. Never mind that it had radioactive material. That's just that's just another thing.
Well, that's a good example of adding value earlier in the process rather than doing the traditional waterfall approach.
Yeah.
So that's it for episode 2, part 1 of the DQMH podcast. In episode 2, part 2, we're going to continue the discussion with Fabiola. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to like, subscribe, or leave a comment. Have a great day.